Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is ACS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limar Technical Met. I'm on Technical Met, going on for about 39 years. It started way back in 1982, and it's here on Limar every Sunday night at 8 p.m. And so I welcome you all to participate, listen, and... Okay, if you can't get me on the radio, then email is a good option. That would be for either mailbag questions or topics you would like to have discussed, or if you would like to share with me some technical science-related puzzle, I like to offer that to the people that means to kind of get under the surface of something important and learn something or relearn something new. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related news item that you saw on YouTube. So the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2es.com. Again, mailbag@, my call sign, alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Links are available for all kinds of things, interesting YouTubes that I've seen, interesting space-related stuff that Paul might discuss as well. Also, some interesting articles that if we get to the science talk segment, I've gone through, and if not, you can read them at your leisure. They're all available on the link. This week, I also added a little bit of a book review. I've been reading some interesting books, so I'm sharing that with people on my link page. You get to it by typing in roy.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you to the link page. It'll be available 24/7, so you don't have to look at it tonight. You can look at it at any old time that you want to. In addition, I like to remind people that I stream the audio of the TechNet and everything that goes on in Glen Oak Repeater. That's available with any internet access. Just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And that will bring you the audio. And I always want to remind people that Mike AC2NJI has a great archive of TechNets going back as far as September 2006. So that's available at his website, amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you my plans for this evening. Okay, as per usual, the plan is I will take questions and comments from the audience. They will tell me their first name and their call sign. I will put them down on a list and we will address each question or comment in a nice orderly fashion. If we run out of questions, I'll open it up for just any kind of general technological discussion, science, medicine, just general questions about medicine. We do not diagnose or treat over the radio. And if there's any other time, I may do the science talk segment again and discuss some science news that I've seen in websites and such. That should take us to 10:15. Then Paul, WS2N, will bring us the SpaceNet report. That'll take us up to 11 o'clock, and I will return to wish everyone well, tie a bow on it, and call it a night. So, if the repeater, my radio, my amplifier, and my microphone all behave tonight, that's the plan. So I will drop and ask everyone out there if they have any questions or comments to the technical net, please give me your first name and your call sign.
2OGB, you know what to do, Roy.
Craig recognized, Craig's first on the list. Anyone else want to join them there? Give me your first name and your call sign. Please repeat yourself. There was a lot of noise. I couldn't make out much. Okay, nothing heard. Perhaps it's the Pennsylvania repeater bleeding through. That sometimes happens on my station. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. So if anyone else out there has any questions or comments for the net tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. I'll put you on our list here.
KD2OGB, you know what to do.
Antec Shane, question, you've got my issue emails. Did you find anything interesting?
Well, Well, I mean, they're interesting, Wesley. Part of it entails a piece of equipment that probably no one but you could get your hands on for anything less than, you know, $70,000. Then there's that discussion of that weird grounded antenna. You know, that's of interest. So, yeah.
So there was impedance matching, noise cancellation, done instead of an antenna for TechNet. And we found it for education and entertainment. I don't know, have you had a chance to see all of it?
Yes, I took a look at all of it. The impedance matching you discussed last week, and I even put it on my link page, and I mentioned that Andy kind of did that a couple of months ago in Andy's Corner, discussing impedance matching and that the maximum power transfer occurs when you match impedances of original load. So we kind of covered that, but if you want to touch base on one of the other subjects, that's fine.
Yeah, so it would be around 9:30 before everybody else is going to take the return. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So I'll pencil you in for later in the second half of the sciencey talk. So Craig, I have you listed. I heard you both times. So you're there. You're number one on the runway. I just wanted to know if anyone wanted to keep you company there in the number two or three slot. So anyone else out there with any questions or comments to make to the technical net tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, hopefully things will liven up as time goes on. Craig, what's your question or your comment for tonight?
Here's something that I've looked into if I thought of getting perhaps a new car or maybe changing how things look in my current car. So, head on my Kenwood TMV71A. Is there a way how I can do this without compromising the seat itself? I want to slip a gooseneck into the car seat bolt and then hang the remote head from there. Is there a possibility how I can do that?
Okay, do you want to remind everyone what model car you have in case there's some guy out there who knows whether that's doable or not?
2015 Cherokee.
Okay, very good. I am not particularly a motor vehicle maven, so I don't really know whether or not that's doable. I mean, ultimately, probably all these things are doable to one degree or another, depending upon how much you wanna mess up the car. But if there's anyone out there who is familiar with the architecture of a 2015 Cherokee and knows if it is a relatively easy thing to place something like the gooseneck that Craig is interested in, please hit that push to talk button.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, Jeff.
Okay, let's see if I'm working. Okay. Hi, Jeff, 86MB. I personally don't, but I recommend that he tries the one of the Papa Nets, the Thursday night net, or the Antenna Net, which is on Friday night. And we've got about how to run antennas throughout the car and things like that. I know guys have various jeeps and whatnot, so that might be a good place to drop off. Maybe 6M.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Jeff, AB6MB is the host of the Papa Network Antenna Tech Net. Every Friday night, 10 o'clock our time. The Papa Network also has a roundtable technical net on Thursday nights at 11 o'clock our time, There are numerous different ways of getting into the PAPA network. One of them is Echolink. Probably that's the easiest way. I use other XRF gateways, but Echolink is probably the easiest. So, okay, that's a good idea. Thank you, Jeff. So, Craig, there's one option of kind of widening your base. The guys on the West Coast are big drivers, too, so maybe you'll find someone with practical experience, just in case anyone else out there listening tonight has any practical experience or any further suggestions. Please hit the push to talk and ID yourself.
KB6MU,
yes, Jeff, you wanted to add something?
You did mention, which is a good idea, of Echolink. To get into our Echolink, we're on there's a conference called PAPA, star PAPA, star P-A-P-A, star. And it's really easy to click on that and come on in. Be patient when you try to get in, because you're a lot slower on the draw on the Echolink coming into our system. You might have to take you a couple tries, but if you can't get in, I've done it. So anyway, back to you, 86.
Okay, very good, Jeff. Well, Craig is very very capable on Echolink. We've had more than a few conversations with me being on the radio after the TechNet is over and him being on his Echolink connection. So he knows the joys of dealing with Echolink. So like I mentioned, that's as good an idea as any, because unfortunately I get the sense, generally speaking, that our audience tonight is not that familiar with 2015 Cherokees and the modifications that you're curious about, Craig.
It's not a big deal. I'm not really in a rush, but it's something to give me an idea on so I can give it, I guess, a better way how I can reach for stuff, since I have it mounted in the dead center of my windshield just above where my FM radio is, so I just wanted to maybe move it down below the four-way hazard light switch and put it down there so that it's, easier to work with.
Yeah, that's understandable. I'll ask a semi-silly question. Have you Googled the subject? Because I find that there's an incredible amount of knowledge on the Internet. Sometimes it's bad knowledge, sometimes it's wrong knowledge, but a lot of times it's right, or at least it'll give you good ideas to start off with. So have you attempted to try the Google option?
Okay. Weeks ago, when I was in the AirTrain building on my downtime, and I didn't really find much, but what I just want to know is, how can I slip the gooseneck under there, like, without causing any issues to the seat? Because it looks like a regular bar, what are those things? Those bar wrenches? I forgot the actual name of them, but, yeah, those long wrenches, even that, hooking the bolt from the part.
Again, I don't know, unfortunately. A lot of things have been becoming very proprietary with automobiles. I guess they're suspicious that individuals who used to be able to fix their cars, now that they're full of computers and other esoteric equipment, would like to deter people from doing that. So, you know, it kind of fits together in this morass that is the right to fix your own stuff movement that's picking up steam. So once again, don't know anything about that, but if anyone out there has any familiarity with proprietary, methods of locking stuff down in the Cherokee, please hit the push to talk button.
OGB, I think it's really dead tonight, Roy. I don't think I'm really going to get much help. I'll try to figure this out later on. Maybe a couple more TechNets that we have later on, if we get a bigger audience, maybe I'll try to re-ask my question, or maybe you could pass it along to some people, or maybe email me if anybody's got an idea. So I'm not much in a rush. Again, I just want to try to slip a gooseneck into the bolt of the passenger seat and then just have it hang off where the under my radio. So that's just what I want to do. Anyway, let me get going. I got a friend waiting for me on a voice chat, so I'll say 7-3, thank you. AC2GS, deck control, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good, Craig. Thanks for coming. Thanks for participating. Anyone out there, if they have any thoughts later on, Craig, KD2OGB, is probably in QRZ or in the roster if you're a club member, so it won't be that difficult to be able to contact them via email. So if something pops into your head, you want to share it, send Craig a little email. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. I'm hoping that some people have wandered over to the radio who have some questions or some comments tonight. If that's the case, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, it appears that things are a little bit slow tonight. I don't know if it's the holidays or the beginning of fall. I don't know. We'll see. Let's just open it wide. So if anyone wants to discuss any topic, science-related, medical-related, what have you, we're open for all kinds of things tonight. If you got a question, we'll try our best. So if you have anything along those lines, or you want to make a comment along those lines, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and call sign.
Is WA2VDH with a comment from last week?
Yes, John.
Yeah, I remember last week there was some discussion about the impedance that you see at a parallel resonant circuit when it hits resonance. And I just checked it out just to verify it in the handbook. Pretty much when you hit parallel resonance, and this holds through HF, when you hit parallel resonance, the impedance you see is high, and it is pretty much the unloaded Q of the coil times X sub L, times the inductive reactance. You see this as a high resistance looking into the parallel resonance circuit. And pretty much the Q of the coil stays fixed because even though it's X sub L over R series, as the frequency goes up because of skin effect, the AC resistance goes up. So the Q tends to stay fairly fixed. If you want to verify it, in the I have the 2017 handbook there. There is a verification of that. Under the article, parallel circuits of moderate to high Q, and it shows it as pretty much the unloaded Q of the coil times X sub L.
Okay, very good, John. I think we kind of came to the same sort of conclusion last week, thankfully. There was a little give and take, and it was an interesting question. I didn't realize that it's sitting there in the handbook. When I was a youngster, I actually read through the whole darn handbook, but I haven't been able to find the time to kind of do that. When I was a little kid, I was one of those kids that kind of read through the encyclopedias and such. So it may be time for that once again. But thanks, John, for pointing that out. I think it was an interesting subject. Some people kind of thought that we were kicking a dead horse after a while, but, you never know what you'll learn. If you turn over a rock, you never know what you find.
Yeah, it holds pretty much as long as the Q is greater than 10. If it's a low Q circuit, then things kind of get muddled up, become a little more complicated, but as long as the Q is 10 or greater, moderately high Q, Q X sub L is enough to follow.
Okay, very good. We've learned our lesson. I'm probably not going to be making any antenna traps in the near future. But Tony, NY2A, came to us with that question. He also sent me some interesting forum discussions of amateur radio operators taking on the same subject matter. So it's an interesting subject that we discussed. Why, thank you.
So you mentioned reading through the encyclopedia. Just brought back a memory when my parents used to get the one new volume every month of the Funk and Wagnalls encyclopedia when A&P was putting it out each month.
Yeah, I had a very, very similar experience at my local supermarket with, I think it was Green Stamps or whatever they gave away. You could buy the next bit of what was it? It was an encyclopedia. It wasn't Funk and Wagnalls. It certainly wasn't Britannia. It was, I think, Columbia. I think it was the Columbia Encyclopedia. So every week or every month you got a different insert and you bought the case that holds them all together. And I still have that big heavy thing sitting on a bookshelf someplace in my basement. I loved reading through that book. Some people read through encyclopedias, others just kind of show them off to people, others just do what they're kind of designed to do when you have a question. Before Google came around, you look stuff up and you figure stuff out. I wonder how many people actually are thumbing through real encyclopedias anymore, if they're not either going to Wikipedia or just Google searches these days.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, I tend to think you miss a little bit of something without an encyclopedia, but then I'm a very pro-book type of a guy. I got the electronic book from Amazon, the Kindle. Interesting. I kind of don't like the screen being as small as it is. I'd rather it be larger, but I really like the feel of paper and books and such, so it's going to be kind of difficult to teach this dog new tricks, I guess.
Yeah, I also remember they had, I think it was for it was a big dictionary, too, that I think it was A&P. Same way, every month they would give you another section of it, and finally, after a couple of years, you had this humongous, unabridged dictionary that you would put together and had to sit on a lectern because it weighed, it must have weighed about 20-25 pounds.
Oh, that would have been interesting. I would have loved that. It almost sounds like the Oxford Dictionary. I don't know if you've ever seen the micro-sized version. The regular edition is probably as many volumes as Britannica, but they sold a version where they shrunk the print and included a magnifying glass because there was absolutely no one that they were expecting to read that stuff without a magnifying glass. I never actually saw a real one. I saw loads of pictures of them.
Yeah, I guess they had pretty much every word in this language, pretty much.
Yeah, well, I think they do a thing. A lot of dictionary companies do this thing once a year, and they announce that they're including new words because, you know, as the culture changes, we come up with terms or different meanings for old terms and such. So they're always adding words. I have a subscription to OED. It's a very interesting. If you're interested in entomology, it's a fascinating thing. And Oxford Dictionary is very useful. One of the books on the reading list that I included in my links tonight is a book by a woman who explains how the English language got to look strange, you know, where different things, the same thing are pronounced different things. And she even touched upon that old joke of why do you park on a driveway and drive on a parkway? So entomology of words is also something fascinating to me. So dictionaries are fun, people.
Is that what they also call a philologist?
Well, I mean, a philologist, I think, is more into just the general study of literature. Not necessarily the ideology, etymology of each individual word. Could be wrong.
I know, I always remember from this planet that Morbius was a PhD, also philologist. Remember that from the movie. Anyway, I'm rambling. I'll let you carry on with it then.
Okay, did you just allude to Forbidden Planet?
Yeah, I remember in that movie that he mentioned, or when they were coming in for the approach to Altair 4, that he was a PhD also in philology. I think that's how he understood the origin of the term id.
Okay, I mean, that was one of my favorite 1950s science fiction movies. It was... It's based on Shakespeare, The Tempest. It takes a great deal of license, and it turns the magician into a scientist, which makes as much sense as anything. I think it was something like 3-4 years ago. Me and Dick just kept on talking about Forbidden Planet and the Altair system, and you know where the Altair system would be, and all kinds of fun stuff. So I'm a fan as well.
Yeah, that movie and also, I guess, the original Day the Earth Stood Still, those movies, they stand out as the high point of the 50s science fiction movies. I guess the low point is Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, thankfully, I never saw that in my childhood. I saw that later on when Ed Wood became a kind of curious, odd fellow. I liked when the Earth Stood Still as well. I liked Michael Rennie. I really found him weird enough that if there was anyone I wanted to play an alien, it would have been Michael Rennie. Because I think he was like that in real life. They had a robot as well, although I still prefer the robot in Forbidden Planet. I have a few of those, and I have only one little figure of Gort in my chat. So I think Robbie is at least 3-1 over Gort.
Yeah, it was disgusting, the remake of that movie. They took away all of the fascinating side points of it, like the fact that Sam Jaffe was working on the mathematics of the drive system for his saucer that he got. He was working out that mathematics. The remake of that movie really stunk. It was really a travesty what he did. But the original Day the Earth Stood Still, that was really a gem. Okay, I'll let you get back to the next.
Okay, I just want to put in my 2 cents as well. I tend to not like remakes. Overwhelmingly, remakes are rather bad. I think ultimately the problem is that the people doing the remake don't really understand the movie they're remaking. They know it was popular or it has name recognition, and they just want the recognition. They want the branding, and so they just go off on their own about the story, so it gets messed up. The only remake of a 1950s movie that was significantly better than the original, my humble opinion, was a movie called The Fly. Jeff Goldblum did a great job on that, and so did the director. But other than that, a lot of remakes are awful. I could go down the list, which I probably shouldn't bother to, but there's a lot of things that are remade where it just doesn't have the bite. It doesn't have the sensibility that the original had, so I'm thinking that the people who made it just were in it for the brand and not really for the substance.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John, for a trip down memory lane. I loved my science fiction. One of my guiltiest pleasures of a bad, really bad science fiction movie, bad acting, bad production values, not great plot. For some odd reason, it endlessly amused me. It was the creation of the humanoids. So any of you film buffs out there, if you ever come across creation of the humanoids and you're in a jocular mood, serious mood isn't going to really help, but if you're kind of in a goofy mood, take a look at the creation of the humanoids. It's incredibly amusing, to me at least. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and this still is the Limewalk Technical Mess. So if you have any technical questions or technical comments, or scientific questions, or science comments, or you want to discuss some aspect generally of medicine, whatever, I'm available. I'm here. You're here. So if you got anything, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I've always wondered, if you have an antenna that's 5 feet above the roof of a house, let's say a flat roof, but the roof is 20 stories high, does it negate the height, because it's only 5 feet above the roof, that you're 20 stories up? Go ahead.
No, it does not. If I guess theoretically it was a big metal shell that was totally grounded to earth ground, it might. But since no edifice that I'm aware of has that property, elevation is the most important thing. The small amount of conducting material inside the building does not really lead it to behave as though it was at the level of the ground. So, you know, unless it's built very strangely and has a lot of conductive material, no. The elevation in a building is still good elevation.
Okay, so what you're saying is still taking advantage of the building's elevation and not losing any advantage because you're only 5 feet off the top of the roof.
Yes, indeed. I mean, just take as an example, guys out there who build these 100-foot towers. They're made of conductive material. They're electrically bonded to each other. They're grounded. And yet, most of us would kill for an opportunity to have a tower like that in our backyard. So height makes might. You don't have to concern yourself that the structure will impose a certain limitation of the elevation of your radiating antenna.
All right, it's got it. Thanks, Rich.
You're welcome. Anyone with any other comments about this, please hit the push to talk button.
Hey, Ed.
Yes, Ed.
Oh, hi, this is Mike. No doubt about it. Well, years ago when I lived in the Bronx in a six-story apartment house, the antenna was about 15 feet off the roof, and that was great. I did have an antenna in Europe 15 feet off the ground. Let me just stop a minute. And that antenna was... three halfway lengths long, and to impedance match it, it was for 20 meters. To impedance match it, I fed it a quarter wave from one end, and every night I spoke to the East Coast in the United States over.
Very good. Well, in general, it's always good to elevate your radiating antenna. You can get away with things if they're vertically oriented because of the takeoff angle, but certainly anything horizontal, unless, of course, as we mentioned a couple of months ago, there were some people deeply interested in near vertical incident sky waves, where they wanted most of the sky waves to fly up very, very close to 90 degrees, up the tangent of the ground and go straight up and back down again for much more local communication. So for people with near vertical incident skyways needs, you want to get it relatively low to the ground. But for the rest of us who want to talk to the rest of the world, antennas work best when they're at least a half a wavelength above the ground, and you know, a little bit higher doesn't hurt either. And of course, Dick, K2RIW, would regularly say there's three important things about UHF and VHF antennas, and they were basically elevation, elevation, and elevation. Those are the three things about getting a good signal, since UHF and VHF are primarily line-of-sight means of transmission. So the higher you get it up, the farther your line-of-sight is, and that's why we like to put our repeaters as high up as humanly possible. Okay, I heard a little something in the background, just in case I doubled with someone. If there was someone out there trying to transmit, please ID. Okay, perhaps not. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions of a technical nature, science, medicine, what have you, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign, and we'll see what we can do.
AC2GS, this is KD2WOT. I have a question.
Sure, what's your question?
Okay, well, I'm fairly new to the hobby. In fact, very new. I was only licensed in June. But I have an FT-991A. And I also, the way I kind of got into the hobby was with an SDR, which is the SDR play unit. So I have another device that's basically similar to a device made by MFJ. I think it's 1708. It's a relay device that allows you to share the same antenna. Are you with me so far?
Yes, I'm following you.
Okay, so the question has to do with the quality of the receive on the Yaesu FT-991. For example, I can barely hear this repeater on that. However, when I listen to it on the SDR, it is, you know, clear as a bell.
Are you using the same antenna for both systems, or are they different antennas?
No, it's the same antenna being used for both systems. And this device, the device is similar to the MFJ 1708. So it basically, it's a device that allows you to share the antenna among the SDR and the transmitter without overloading the SDR.
Yeah, it's a transmit-receive switch. It senses when RF is coming and directs it away from the SDR, which is not capable of handling large amounts of power input.
Correct. So it has the ability to sense the RF, and it also has the ability to attach a PTT switch. So I attached a PTT switch to it as well. And so that's kind of like a backup for that. I didn't want to overload the device. But anyway, there's such a dramatic difference in the receive. And, you know, my question is, since I don't really have any perspective, I don't know if there's something wrong with the FT-991, for example.
Well, different radios could be set to different levels. There might be a preamp switched in for the SDR that isn't for the 991. You might have a preamp switch. You might want to try it. First thing I would try and do, firstly, is to just take the transmit-receive switch out of the equation and just straight plug the 991 to the antenna input and see what kind of power level you're receiving feeder at. if you're getting the same low signal strength, then it's certainly not the TR switch, and you could then go on to figure out whether there's something wrong with the 991A, or its settings need to be kind of optimized.
Yes, so I did that. I actually bypassed the transmit relay and the SDR completely, and, you know, the signal did increase a bit, but it's still not the same level of quality that the SDR produces.
Okay, well, again, did you try switching in the preamp? And if so, did that improve anything?
Yeah. Well, I did do that in the past. I can't seem to find that setting now on here.
Oh, okay. Well, if anyone, again, I don't have a 991A. If anyone has a 991A and can kind of tell us how you enable the preamp, I would sort of think that that's kind of an important thing. So there should be a button on it rather than a menu selection. But modern computers sometimes hide things in the menus. So if anyone offhand knows where the preamp switch for VHF is hidden in the 991A, please hit that push to talk.
Well, it's a setting that says IPO, so it's IPO and then AMP 1 and then AMP 2. But right now, as I look at it, that setting is grayed out. It doesn't allow me, it's not allowing me to change it, so I don't understand.
Okay, I wish I could help you with that. Again, I don't have a 991A. Never really used one, so that's a curious one. You know, always is an option at a lot of our ham get-togethers. Andy, WA2CDL, has a tune-up table, and you know, he could figure out what the gain is on your receiver and be able to tell you if it's a reasonable gain or the signal strength is. You know, not reasonable. So it could be a setting, or it could be something wrong with the 991A.
Okay, thank you very much. I won't tie up the net anymore. Kind of what I figured, but, you know, I have no, you know, I don't have any other hams around me that I'm, you know, that I'm aware of, and I have no perspective. That's the problem.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. And there is a degree of variability. Different radios have slightly different sensitivities. They have different selectivities. Some are more sensitive to desensing when near a off-frequency transmission. So, you know, especially if you're starting off, you don't know what's just in the nature of the variable aspect of the equipment and what indicates a failure with some of the equipment. A lot of times, you know, people get deeply confused when they have more than one standing wave ratio meter in their chain, because almost never do they all line up with the exact same number. They're all a little bit different because they're calibrated in different ways for different frequencies, and based upon that in aging, they give slightly different readings. So if you're not aware of that, you kind of look at these slightly off standing wave ratios and you say, all these meters are garbage. But that's the nature of these meters, unless they're really expensive and highly calibrated pieces of equipment. They're approximations. So I can understand why, you know, you wish you had more experience. But, you know, time will solve that. As time goes on, you'll have more experiences that will give you a better sense of all this.
KC1SAM.
Yes, Sam.
Preamps only work on HF and preamp 2 meters. It's not in a circuit, so it'll be grayed out.
Okay, that makes sense, although it's odd that they don't offer a preamp for UHF VHF, but okay.
Hope that helps them out. That's about it. Now you know why it isn't. Solved it. KC1SAM. Standby.
Okay, very good, Sam, thank you. That mystery is solved.
Sam, a cigar.
Well, cigars aren't that healthy. You know, probably something healthier.
Into ADG with a comment.
Yes, certainly. What's your comment?
Yeah, hi, Roy. It's Dave in Massapequa. Just a quick question for the gentleman with the 991. I'm not, you know, terribly familiar with the radio itself, but is it possible? Is it possible that he has an attenuator that is switched in and he's not aware of that, and that's affecting his received performance? Roy, back to you.
Okay, that's an interesting point. A lot of radios have attenuated circuits that can be triggered in case you're in a situation where you're getting too strong a signal and you need to dampen it. So, and I guess it's possible to accidentally trigger the attenuator. So, have you checked out the setting of the attenuation setting for the 991H, Chris?
No, actually, I have, and I don't know where to find the attenuator setting. I probably have to do a little bit more research.
Okay. Again, I would tend to assume that if the attenuator was in line, there probably should be some indication on the display. That's kind of an important thing to be on top of. Again, don't have a 991A. I have a Flex 6700. I have an IC7100. I have a Yaesu FDM400. Don't have anything like the 991A, so I'm not aware. But thank you, Dave, for that suggestion. Yeah, an attenuator would cause a similar situation as well.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you to Sam and Dave and obviously to Roy. I appreciate the help. By the way, I noticed the exact same issue on HF also. And that's a completely different antenna and a completely different, you know, antenna plug in the back of the radio.
KC1SM.
Yes, Sam.
The attenuator RF gain is the middle knob on the right side. Again, it doesn't work on 2 meters. It's for HF.
Yes, that is set fully clockwise.
Okay, so again, I don't know. Ultimately, the way to figure it out is to inject a signal into the radio and see what it records, the signal strength. You know, other things are kind of soft and squishy. It may simply be that it doesn't have the gain of the SDR play front end. Okay, unfortunately that was about 90-95% noise, so if you can either maneuver the antenna slightly different or kick up the gain, the output of your final transmitter circuit, give it another try.
Alpha Bravo 69 Bravo.
Okay, Jeff?
Yeah, I was wondering if you can say for the SDR method, so the SDR would match the 991 IDOT. That's because of the
Okay, Jeff, I could barely make out. I've never heard Echolink have that much background noise. Again, you're about 80% noise, so I'm confused of what could possibly be doing that. Maybe the audio driver is hiccuping or it's picking up some RF local, I don't know. But for some odd reason, your audio is very noisy.
I have no idea.
Okay, Jeff, I don't know the reason for it. I don't know if it's local here or something going on with Echolink. I don't have a clue. But I appreciate your attempt. Once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Linemark Technical Net, and we're open for business. If you have any questions, please give me your first name and your call sign.
W2DZ?
Yes, Rich.
Not local to you because I'm experiencing 95% noise on his signal also. Go ahead.
Okay, but I'm just saying that it may be due to the Echolink at Belden or something between him and the Echolink server or his. I think he disconnected and reconnected, so maybe he wants to try one more time. So we'll drop the push to talk for a little bit and give him a chance to send another signal through.
Okay, I did reboot. And I did reconnect. That's real weird before I get it. So how do you call it now?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the same background noise. I don't have the faintest idea what's going on. What I would suggest, one of the other people who's sitting there on Echolink, if you can transmit, you don't have to say too much. I just want to get a sense of where in the Echolink chain the noise might be. So if any of you other people do an Echolink have the ability to have a mic nearby and give it a try, I just want to hear what the background audio sounds like.
Well, I guess that's my cue, K7WJN.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bill. I appreciate it. So it might be a problem in Selden. I'll have to talk to Lou because even Bill has that background noise coming in. So I don't know, I wish things were working out a little bit better for Echolink tonight. But I don't know if Lou is out there. If he is, you might want to look into this. Otherwise, I'll send him an email when we're done for tonight. Okay, so we now have more understanding of what might be going on with Echolink, unfortunately. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Linemark Technical Net. If you have a question or a comment of a technical nature, or science-related, medicine-related, what have you, and you would like to ask it or make a comment about it, this is the time, this is the place. So hit the push to talk and say your piece. Give me your first name and your call sign.
W2TZ.
Yes, Rich.
I was watching a couple of football games today, and nobody in the crowd had a mask, and you're talking 75,000 people. I mean, if there is a repercussions from that kind of flagrant attempt at ignoring the wisdom of science, how and when will that be learned? And do you think, in fact, because it was outside, that there could be repercussions or might not be? Go ahead.
Well, being outside is a little bit better than being inside, so it's not as much of a travesty. My next question is, offhand, I assume there was no real social distancing going on, that people were packed next to each other. Was that the case?
Like sardines.
Okay, so unfortunately, this is not unusual. People grow tired of things. To one degree, it's simple pandemic fatigue with the ones who are actually paying attention to the requests of the CDC and other such agencies. In other cases, if people taking the opportunity to try and make this into a full statement for some strange reason. And for other people, they're worried about the alien DNA and the vaccines and all kinds of weird things. So it's a mishmash of all of these things. It's nothing special. If you read any of the books on the great Spanish flu pandemic, you had all kinds of nonsense. People do not particularly act in their own best interest, given half a chance. So it will be problematic, and there will be repeated bumps. Thankfully, the down south things are getting a little bit better. There are some places in the Midwest that are lagging behind. I assume that ultimately it'll be very reminiscent of when the last peak ended and it's dropped down. But all things being equal, the way we're taking this, once again, I would not be surprised if 2-3 months from now we see another bump going up. Different places will have a bigger bump than other places, depending upon how many of them are either vaccinated or have been infected in the past and what their response to all this is. But this is going to be a chronic problem that's going to stick with us for a while, and even far worse, because the majority of people outside of industrialized world have hardly been vaccinated. They remain as massive reservoirs of the virus as it's given a chance to mutate all over the place. So I don't even have the faintest clue what kind of variant will come next. I hope nothing terrible, but there's always that chance. So not out of the... out of this mess far yet, and a lot of us are not really doing the best that we can do, but again, that's what human beings tend to do.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Last week I sat through, I don't know how many hours of drag racing from Indianapolis. They set up a drag racing track in that same location. And they had, I don't know, there had to be 100,000 people there. And the same thing, like football games. And then do interviews. They'd go down to the garage and the pits and inside the garage. And none of the announcers, the people doing interviews, nobody. Drivers, nobody had masks on. The mechanics, they're talking to mechanics. The mechanics are putting, you know, working on the cars. Zero. I couldn't believe it. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, unfortunately, that doesn't surprise me. This has been kind of what we've been looking at, depending upon what direction we look at, from the very beginning. You know, I like to think of ourselves as rational creatures. Oftentimes, we're not. We're driven by emotions and all kinds of tribalism and all kinds of things. Public health, in my humble opinion, should not be a political indicator. There shouldn't be a Democratic or Republican or Libertarian or conservative or liberal or what have you way of treating an infectious process. China is a communist. For the most part, they did what should be done. They're more draconian, they have less freedom, they have more of an ability as a governmental agency to force people to behave, and I'm sure more right-wing countries someplace out there must have taken this infection seriously, but I don't understand why there's so much irrationality in the world, this particular year and a half have been a stark indicator that that ain't going to change anytime too soon. So, we'll hope for the best. We hope that for the most part the vaccinations and the boosters will limit our local exposure and risk, and that the Russian roulette going on in Africa and South America or amongst millions and millions of people who haven't gotten the vaccine and have no chance of getting one anytime too soon blows up in our face. We'll have to see what happens. It's going to be a bumpy ride to the end of this one.
I'll bet you most of the people don't know whether wearing a mask helps them or their neighbors.
Well, you know, I can't blame them 100%. The problem, among other things, is that people don't really understand how science works. What little exposure I think most people have had to science is a science textbook where they say when things were invented, discovered, figured out, and that's the end of that. So all this going back, forth, up and down confuses the heck out of them and leads to a lack of confidence in the professionals who are changing recommendations. The recommendations are based upon our real-time reality. Different situations have caused those professionals to change their requests, suggestions, and behaviors for different reasons. At some point, the mask was primarily to protect others from an infected person spreading it by them wearing the mask. In other cases, it's been wearing the mask to protect yourself from other people spreading it at you. So it kind of ebbs and flows because no one has 20/20 hindsight here. So I can sort of understand why people have lost track of what the mask does. I think in general, it's important to be a good citizen. Protect yourself, protect your loved ones, protect your neighbor, protect the people around you. So whether it's benefiting you a little bit more or less than it protects the other people around you, I don't think is that important in the equation, personally.
And why not? Do they not equal each other?
Well, it depends upon what's going on. If you have been fully vaccinated and the vaccine took, then for the most part, you're theoretically wearing a mask it sort of depends. You can still become infected. There is breakthrough infections. The breakthrough infections are a lot less likely, and the extent of the infections are a lot less. So in those cases, you're wearing it for both protection, so that even though you're vaccinated, there is that small chance of becoming infected with something like Delta. And also, if you are infected with Delta, which is possible, you can be deeply asymptomatic, feel nothing but shed viruses. And so people out there who haven't been vaccinated or wandering around in your field can become infected by you. So a lot of times it's both. You're doing it for yourself and for the people around you. Sometimes it's a little bit more of one than the other, depending upon what specifically is going on with everyone.
What's the latest figure on how many people have died in the USA from COVID?
Well, according to my records, it's something along the ways of 677, a little bit under 678,000 deaths that are related to coronavirus.
Boy. That's a serious, serious number.
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, and the nature of it is it's not a constant number spread out in the entire country. The health organizations could probably deal with it a little bit easier if that was the case. What happens is that it crests and in different places. And in some areas, it's brought on disaster. I think in Ohio, some places in Ohio, they've gone into what's considered combat triage, in which the hospitals are completely filled in some places. The facilities to care for people are overloaded. They have to actually decide on those that they're going to use heroic measures and those that they're just going to make comfortable until the end. And that's a terrible thing to happen to a person. It's not a great thing to have to deal with as a health professional. You're not out there to triage and let people die. The idea is to save everyone. But the resources are limited. And so when different areas of the country all of a sudden have ridiculously high levels of infection and require respirators and oxygen and all kinds of things, it reaches a point where you run out of the supply. You got lots of trouble. So it's a sad, sad thing to watch.
Well, I think therein lies the rub. How many of us have actually seen documentary footage of somebody on a respirator who is taken off a respirator because they don't need it anymore because they're dead? I don't think it's brought to not nearly enough close to home to really get the impact of it. At least in the media, I haven't seen it.
Well, I can sort of understand it's not really something that people want to televise and show at the dinner table during, you know, during nighttime news and such. They report it with text. They report it with their voices. I don't think family members, God forbid, would you want a loved one to be televised, been given up on? I don't think I would. So I don't think we're that sad that we actually need documentary evidence of someone signing off on the fact that they're not quite dead yet, but because there's absolutely no respirators and there's, say, a 20-year-old who has no health problems who desperately needs that ventilator, I don't know. I don't think you're ever going to see that in video form, unless someone just kind of is playing games with their cell phone, and they'll probably be taken to court by the hospital and probably by the living relatives of the dead person. I don't know. I don't know if that's necessary. I read the reports in Italy when they had that problem early on. Northern Italy was smack silly before we were. And they were doing combat triage in their hospitals. And I don't know. I took it as realistic. I didn't need to see videos of them unplugging live people from respirators.
Well, there are ways to get around it by blurring out faces, which they do now. And you can even change the pitch of somebody's voice to make it almost impossible to know who the person is. I just think it's too far away. Unless you have a family member who's actually died of it, it's too far away to not scare people enough. But to see a football stadium of 75,000 people shoulder to shoulder without masks on is insane.
Personally, by the way, I'm AC2GS. Personally, I would think looking and seeing ICE trucks lined up in the back of local neighborhood hospitals, as was happening in New York last year, should be all that you need to make you realize that something is terribly wrong. But again, I'm sure there are people out there, maybe even listening, who say, well, yeah, sure. A lot of those guys didn't die of COVID. They died of other things, and they got listed either because of the deep state or because laziness or because they got more money for it or 15,000 other schemes. Some people, you'll show them the documentary and evidence, and they'll say they're all actors. I mean, there are people out there who think that we never got to the moon. So, lots of luck.
I guess. Back to Net Control, W2BZ.
Okie doke, thank you, Rich. Once again, this is AC2GS, name is Roy. This is the Weimar Technical Net. So, if you got any technical questions, or science questions, or medicine questions, or questions of the nature of the universe, what have you, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, and give me your first name and your call sign.
Ken, WB2KWC.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, good evening, Roy. This past conversation has got me thinking, and I have a question about the vaccinations. Is there anything essentially different between the first vaccination you receive, the second one, and then the upcoming booster shots? Are they basically the same thing, or are they different mixtures, or different strengths, or... I'm just curious.
Yes, well, let's do it in order. The first and second shots of Moderna and the other company are identical. It's just the duration and then the second shot. So there's nothing different in the mix. Pfizer and Moderna, concentration, volume, what have you. Two identical shots. The third shot really hasn't been finalized. There's been a lot of talk about it, but you'll notice that the FDA has not kind of given their blessing quite yet. Early on, I think about 4 months ago, there was some talk of from Pfizer that they were starting to work on a slightly modified version using the same technology mRNA for the slightly different Delta variants and these new variants. I haven't heard that that's a part of the mix because you're going to have to go through a phase one, phase two, phase three study before you get approval for that. And that's going to kind of slow them down. So I think they jumped the gun and they decided to simply give another booster of the same exact material. They're also wondering out loud to each other of if you took the first two Moderna shots, can you take a Pfizer booster shot? So that, again, has been not well determined. So at this point, at least, it's clear that the booster will be identical to the previous shots that you took.
Okay. Thank you, Roy. I was just curious. And I guess I'm with you in the fact that they really have not committed too much information to what the booster is going to be like.
I hate to throw fire, wood, you know, any kind of accelerant on the fire. I think that this is not a well thought out at this point consensus. I think there are people, reasonable people with reasonable expectations, problems, understandings of these things on both ends of when should boosters be given. Because you'll notice if you read the news, when they first talked about the boosters, it tended to be something like 8 months after your second shot. Then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it was 6 months after your second shot. So I think the guys with the degrees and the research white coats and such are arguing with each other and doing tests and reviewing data. And I don't think they really have a consensus quite yet. That's probably why there's a bit of a confusion about this all still.
Okay, thank you very much. I guess I will stay tuned for further details.
Okay, very good, Ken. Thanks for participating. And as I've mentioned in the past, we also have another group, the World Health Organization, who are probably very annoyed at us because they keep on yelling and screaming that the majority of the third world is unvaccinated. They haven't had one shot. We're talking about the third. And that if we spread the love with the vaccine to the rest of the world, the rest of the world will not become a reservoir of possible variants popping up out of nowhere. So the World Health Organization seems to be strongly on the side of, you know, take your third booster shot sometime after most of the world is actually a little safer than they are today. So it gets confusing. Science is messy. Science is confusing. Not as simple as it seems in textbooks. And that's not because these people are stupid or greedy or vindictive or what have you. It's because these people are beings, just like the rest of us. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limar Technical Net. Any questions of a technical, scientific, medical nature, what have you, just hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N. WA1YYQ.
Yes, Paul first and YYQ second.
Okay, I heard Ken on. I think he might be able to answer this question. With the ICOM 7300, I've been looking at the front panel and the back panel on the internet, and I'm looking for a jack where you could plug in CW. You know, I have an electronic key. I'm just wondering if I buy that radio, can I plug that in? On the end of mine, I have a mono plug. But, you know, I'm wondering if I need a different plug or if it comes with a plug. Do they have a quarter inch plug? You know, for that radio, do I have to change it out and go down to a 3.5 millimeter? Yeah, you know, I'm just wondering what the hookup is with the, you know, for an external, in my case, an MFJ electronic key, iambic key. Back to you, Ryan.
Okay, just want to ask you, what model are we talking about? What model radio?
IC7300, the ICOM.
Oh, okay. Ken, do you have a 7300?
Yes, I do. Paul, the connector on the back for the key is a quarter-inch stereo. What you would do is, if you're using an external keyer, or if you're using a straight key or a side swipe or a CUDI key, they're all wired the same way. It's basically a straight key. You would wire the tip and the sleeve, the tip and the ground, basically as a straight key. So the output of your keyer would be a quarter inch tip and sleeve. Or you could also wire the ring and the sleeve together, the middle two, just as long as the tip is, the end is separate. And you can key it like that, no problem. Oh, yes, also, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to tell the 7300 what kind of a key you have. And basically, you push the function button. Then you go in, you select keyer, and in there's a thing to select, is it a bug, a semi-automatic, or a straight key?
Really? Very good. Oh, okay. You know, I've blown up the picture. I don't see a plug. Is the plug on the front panel or the back panel? And, you know, that's one question. And right now I have my straight key and the iambic key hooked up in parallel. You know, so then, you know, this way, you know, they're right next to each other, so I could switch back and forth if I want. You know, really great on straight key night, but you know what I'm saying? I could switch back and forth. It sounds like if I wanted to do that with the new radio, I'd have to unplug it and plug the other one in. I won't be able to leave them in parallel. Anyway, back to you, Ken. WS2N.
No, they can be in parallel. I mean, basically, the output of your keyer is the same as the output of your straight key. It's an open and closed type switching operation. If you look at the back panel, the quarter-inch jack for the key is in the upper right-hand corner of the 7300.
Okay, very good. Okay, this is very good news. Thank you, Ken. Very good. Padupa, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ken. I would assume that basically a bug and a straight key have the same configuration because neither of them need to use any kind of a keyer circuitry. You would need if you had a paddle iambic or just the other type of paddle. You need three conductors, but bugs are I think two conductors. It all goes on that magical reed that's built into the bug.
Okay, very good. It doesn't sound like it's much different. The only thing is I'm going to have to get probably the stereo plug for it, unless it comes with it. I don't know. Right now I have a mono plug plugged into the the HF, the Kenwood. But maybe if Ken's still there, does it come with a plug? Well, I'll just order a stereo plug when I get the radio.
From what I recall, you get one of each type of plug. So you'll get a microphone plug, you'll get a headphone plug, which is a 3.5 millimeter, and you'll also get a quarter inch. From what I recall, you can probably use a mono, which just shorts tip and sleeve to each other. So you can probably just plug it in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't own one, but it would make most sense to me, as long as you have the transceiver configured as a straight key. Whatever signal you're going to be, you would not sending any signal to the ring, you probably can just try plugging it in and see if it works. And if it does, it saves you the time trouble to get an adapter.
Okay, very good. I think I doubled with you in the beginning, Roy. What I said was, thanks for that, and we'll be able to do that, no problem. I was saying, if I have to resolder something, no problem, I can do that, but sounds like all I got to do is plug it in. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ken. YYQ, you wanted to make a comment?
No, not a comment, Roy. I got a question for you. This is WA1YYQ. I'm up here in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I'm a recent member of Limark, so I just wanted to say hello to you and introduce myself, number one, and hello to everybody who's listening. Roy, I've got some issues with engine noise in my car and trying to get a low SWR. I have a Diamond SD330 screwdriver, and I'm operating a Mercedes, and I've grounded the tailpipes, that helped, and I grounded between the straps, between the trunk lid mounts, but I still can't get a really good SWR, and I still can't get rid of some of the engine noise that is coming from a box on the side of the engine. I thought you might have some suggestions. This is WA1YYQ.
Okay, Dan, welcome to the club, I'm sure you're going to enjoy being a member of this great club. Again, not the biggest car guy with electrical equipment. What model car is that again?
It's a Mercedes C300, but I'm talking about HF. I'm not talking about 2 meter. I like to run 80 and 40 meters from the car, and there's this constant engine noise, popping noise, and I've isolated it to a box on the side of the engine. I've spoken to Mercedes, and we even tried grounding the center of the exhaust pipe, also near the engine. That didn't make a difference, and I thought somebody might know something technically about how some of these newer cars work for trying to suppress or get rid of the noise. So that's my question to you, Roy.
Find out if you know any idea what the box's devices are doing. Are they computer chips? What is it? If you were able to get that information, that technical information of what kind of components are in that box that might be causing the problem.
From what I understand, it has something to do with the fuel injection circuitry and the brain work of the car. So what I did is I have a good